Counting the Cost, the 21st talk in a series entitled The Mind of Christ, was presented by Ron Julian on September 25, 2011 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in less than ideal sound quality. The sound quality improved slightly after the first 7 minutes and continues to improve throughout the recording.
We are continuing in our almost completed series called The Mind of Christ. Our goal has been to explore some of the major themes in the teaching of Jesus. I say we're continuing in the series, but we're taking kind of a half a step to the side here. We're going to do things a little differently today. I'm looking at one passage in the Gospel of Luke, and the theme we're going to explore there is the cost of discipleship. Jesus emphasized in his teaching that we should be his disciples, but that it was going to cost us. This passage that I'm going to look at is related to themes that we have explored in earlier sessions: the believer's attitude toward the world, the believer's attitude toward persecution. But today I would like to look at this one passage. It's in Luke 14 that speaks to the cost of being Jesus' disciple. And in particular, the main reason I want to look at it is that there are two somewhat strange parables that Jesus tells here, and I'd like to talk about those parables and what they have to say. But I'd like to look at the surrounding context first. So we're in Luke 14, verse 25. Now great multitudes were going along with him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, and yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Okay, so we're told, it seems fairly clear what his motivation in saying this is. It says that he was being followed by great multitudes. And so you can see him saying to himself, well, I can fix that. So he tells them that being his disciple is costly. If you come to Jesus wanting to be his disciple, first of all, you're going to have to hate your family, father, mother, wife, and so on. Now, I think we've talked about this before in this series. Some of you probably know already what that kind of language means. Others of you may be wondering, what in the world can he be saying? He doesn't mean hate in the sense that we would typically use the word. He doesn't mean you ought to hate your family's guts. That's not what he's getting at. It's a particular use of the concept of what do you love and what do you hate? What you love is what you embrace, what you cling to, what you must have, what you are unwilling to do without. The picture I've always had in my mind, the thing that you love is the thing that you grab as you're going out the door when your house is on fire. It's that one thing. I can't leave till I grab that. That's something that you love. Well, and then hate is the flip side of that. What you hate is not the thing that you would grab when you are going out the door. You grab the thing you love. What you hate is what you are willing to part with because you love something else more. I'm pretty sure that that's the kind of thing that Jesus has in mind. And so what he's saying is, if I am going to follow him, I must be prepared to give up my family. And in the context of what he has to say about this in other places as well, what he's getting at is not, I'm going to have to leave them, so much as in following him, I may end up alienating myself from him. I'm going to have to decide, who do I want to be happy with me? Do I want my family to be happy with me? Or do I want Jesus to be happy with me? That, I think, is what he's getting at. Becoming a disciple of Jesus is something that divides people. Jesus himself said that he came not to bring peace, but a sword. If I love Jesus and follow him wherever he leads, then I may have to part with the approval of my family. And that can be a heavy blow, at least for some of us. Normally, family is that group of people who are on your side. You know, they're the ones that you can count on to be there for you. But Jesus is the spot where you will end up alienating the very people who you would like to count on to be on your side. And so you have to decide whether their approval means more to you than following Jesus. You have to be willing for them to abandon you because they will not follow you in following Jesus. That is what I understand Jesus to mean by hating them. He doesn't mean not liking them or hating their guts or even not, on my part, embracing and wanting to be a part of the family with them. That's not what he's getting at. It's that willingness to say, well, if they're going to walk away from me on this, I'm going to let them walk because I've got to go down this path. Likewise, he says that we must be willing to hate even our own lives. And again, this does not mean, oh, I hate my life. I have such a terrible life. I hate my life. That's not the sort of thing that he's getting at. Again, it's the question, do I love my life or hate it? The issue is whether I am willing to part with it, basically. Is keeping my life in this world now the thing, the non-negotiable for me? I've got to have it. I've got to keep it. If it's going to cost me that life to follow Jesus, then forget Jesus. Or do I hate my life? Do I not hold on to it so tightly? Yes, I would like to preserve it as it is, but I'm not going to hold on to it so tightly that I will not follow Jesus. That, I think, is what he's getting at there. As we have discussed before, I'm pretty sure, in this series, that is also what he means by the next thing he says, when he says we must be willing to carry our cross. At least this is how I understand this phrase, which is different than the way some people do. But I think the emphasis here is on the idea of the cross being an instrument of execution. And I have put it before, it's like saying, in order to follow me, you need to be willing to sit in the electric chair or something like that. The picture is one of embracing the possible rejection by the world that could even lead to my death. A cross is what your enemies hang you on when they want to kill you. So to follow Christ and carry our cross means being willing to follow him even if we end up sharing in the hatred of the world, the hatred that the world feels towards him. Because remember, as it turns out, if you've read to the end of the book, death on a cross is exactly what happened to Jesus. I mean, he was rejected and executed, and it was a cross on which he was executed. So Jesus is telling the crowd that if they want him to be their teacher and leader, they face the possibility of very real loss. They may be rejected by their families, they may even be killed, and they're going to have to decide to accept that and embrace that in order to follow him. Okay, as I said, I'm just trying to get a setup here for the two parables that I'd like to talk about. In verse 28, he tells these two parables. We'll come back to them in a minute. I want to jump to what he says right after the two parables in verse 33. He says, so therefore, after having told the parables, so therefore, no one of you can be my disciple who does not give up all of his own possessions. So the one word that needs explaining here is the word possessions, because this phrase, as we hear it, what I hear when I hear that, you can't be my disciple unless you're willing to give up all your possessions. It sounds like what he's saying is, a prerequisite for following me is that you abandon all possessions. You don't own anything. You get rid of it all. You have nothing. You live on the street. But especially as if we look at the kind of thing that this word can point to, and in the context of what he's talking about, that's clearly not what he's getting at. This word possessions here, I think you could think of it more generally as something like everything that is yours. You're going to need to be willing to part with any and everything that is yours. And it's not just talking about property. It's talking about everything that makes up your life. And in the context, we've already seen the sort of thing that he's talking about. You might want to hang on to the goodwill of your family, but you may have to give it up if you're going to follow him. It's an integral part of your life, but you may have to let go of it if you're going to follow Jesus. You would like to hang on to your life itself. You would like to keep breathing, but you may have to be willing to give it up, to let go of it, in order to follow Jesus. So, I need to hate anything that is in the way of me being a disciple of Jesus and following him. That's basically what he's saying. If you're going to be my disciple, you're going to have to hang on to everything loosely. It might be possessions, it might be relationships, it might even be your life. But you're going to have to hang on to it loosely if you're going to follow me. So, we could paraphrase the basic point of this passage something like this. All who follow Jesus will inevitably come into conflict with the world around them in one way or another. Sometimes following Jesus means losing the love and support of family and friends. Sometimes following Jesus means losing the approval of our neighbors and our society. Sometimes following Jesus means losing our worldly possessions. Sometimes it means losing our lives. It is all worth it. The wealth, the true wealth, which comes to those who follow Christ, is more valuable than anything the world can offer. And we cannot avoid this choice. If we insist on keeping the world's approval, the world's riches, or indeed anything that this world offers, then we're going to find ourselves ultimately coming in conflict with our call to be disciples of Jesus. If we're disciples of Jesus, we have to have, as I say, a loose hold on the world. That is what I think he's saying to the crowd, that multitude that's following him. He's saying, you know, this is what I'm calling you to. This is what this is about. Okay, a lot of that stuff we talked about in an earlier session before, some of those ideas. What I wanted to look at today are these two parables, which are strange little parables, I think, and interesting to me. In all fairness, I should mention that 17 years ago, I wrote an article on these two parables in News and Views, and in what I'm about to say, I am plagiarizing myself greatly. So I would like to think that everyone here remembers everything I have written for the past 17 years, but it's probably not true, so I'm probably safe in this. But if you happen to go back rummaging around and notice that sounds an awful lot like what he said on Sunday, that's right. It does sound an awful lot like it because although I have changed a few things in my thinking, and that's reflected in what I'm saying here, I still think largely what I thought back then. So, these parables, it's hard for me exactly to describe why I found them so interesting. You understand that parables are a particular genre that bring out, they point out to us, hey, I have some interpretive decisions to make here. Jesus has not explained why he told this story. So I'm in this place where I have to go in and try to sort out what was happening. And that has been a big part of my experience. Part of the reason that I stand up here sometimes and talk about stuff is because that has been one of those things that has been very interesting to me, is trying to solve those kinds of problems. What did Jesus mean when he said this? Why did he tell that story? And indeed, the whole Bible is like that to me. I had a very interesting experience with these parables. I'll just tell you personally. This means nothing, by the way. The the interesting experience was I was wrestling with them. I was trying to think. I was not happy with my current understanding of what was going on in these parables, and I was looking at them, and all of a sudden I had what very rarely happens to me. This is why I still remember it, even though it was like at least 17 years ago when this happened, but I had an epiphany. It just all, I was working on these, and all of a sudden it just, the solution to what they were talking about and what was going on just overwhelmingly hit me. It's like, yes, of course. And it was so striking to me, like I had been wrestling and I couldn't see what was going on. All of a sudden, it was just like the light went on, that I stood up and I remember I backed up against the wall, kind of like, whoa. You know, what? It was almost like, what was that? Because it was such a striking experience. What I mean that it doesn't mean anything is I'm not claiming divine inspiration or anything for what I'm saying here. I may be wrong in my understanding of what's going on in these parables, but I still remember that it was one of the funnest times I ever had with in interpreting things. Like, oh man, I think that's right. So I want to talk to you about what I think is going on. I guess I should read them to you first. We're in Luke 14:28. For which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who observe it begin to ridicule him, saying, "This man began to build and was not able to finish." Or what king, when he sets out to meet another king in battle, will not first sit down and take counsel whether he is strong enough with 10,000 men to encounter the one coming against him with 20,000. Or else, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks terms of peace. Okay, so these are strange little stories, I think. On the surface, they seem simple enough, and if you read most commentaries or hear most people who teach on these parables, there's a fairly common way of understanding what Jesus is getting at here. And it would be something like this. Jesus has been talking about how you need to be willing to hate mother and father or be willing to lose your life. So in order to become a disciple of Jesus, you had better count the cost. He uses that language, count the cost. And so the idea is, before you start into this, before you decide to be a disciple of Jesus, you had better stop and think, do I have what it takes to see this through to the end? Do you have what it takes to be a disciple, to give up everything, to carry your cross? You don't want to start being a disciple and then discover halfway through that you don't have what it takes to finish. That's what happens in the story. The man building the tower is embarrassed because he didn't have the resources to finish the tower. Or the king, if he goes to battle against the other king, he's going to lose big. So you want to make sure that if you start into being a disciple, that you have the resources required. You have to count the cost. Do I recognize how much is this going to cost me? And do I have what it takes to pay the price? That's what's usually taught about these parables, but I have a number of problems with that perspective. I don't actually think that's what the parables are, in fact, saying. I don't disagree that discipleship is costly. We just looked at that part. I mean, that's what he was saying. But one of the problems with that perspective to me is, and I think Jack is the one that first pointed this out many years ago, this idea of counting the cost in advance of being a disciple doesn't seem to fit reality. That's not really the way we do this. Whoever does or could count the cost in this way? Speaking personally, I did not have the tiniest clue what being a believer would cost me in this life. When I said yes to Jesus, I had very little idea of what was going to be involved, as in very, very little. I could not possibly have known or understood what God was going to require of me, and if he had shown me then what was going to be required of me along the way, I might have backed off and said, no thanks, I don't think I can do that. I've never really met any believer who became a Christian in the way that this seems to suggest, that you sit down, you tally up the cost and say, yeah, I got what it takes. I'll start into this Believing Jesus project because I think I've got what it takes to make it through to the end. All of us seem to stumble into belief somewhat naive and uninformed. Most of the people that I've talked to have. Okay, furthermore, is it even wise to try to figure out in advance whether we have what it takes to go the distance? How could we possibly know? God himself will take us through trials. God himself will show us what we are made of. I mean, I might look at it and say, I don't feel up to it. But the question isn't really whether I'm up to it, ultimately. The question is, what work is God doing in my life? What should I conclude if I look ahead and it looks really scary and I wonder whether I have what it takes? Is it really Jesus' advice that I should give up before I start because I might not have what it takes? I could understand Jesus warning us in advance that discipleship is demanding, but these parables are saying something stronger and more specific. And this is the place that I wrestled the most with this, is if you look at these stories, the point of the story doesn't seem to be I lost my train of thought. Okay. So, like I said, these parables are saying something stronger and more specific. I think they are saying, don't start something you can't finish. But could Jesus really mean don't become a disciple unless you're sure you can finish? How could any young disciple take this advice? And in fact, if you look at the way the stories are set up, the stories seem to practically congratulate the two people in these stories, for giving up. It certainly was wise of that man not to take on that project of building the tower, because it would have been terrible. He would have been so humiliated when he couldn't finish it at the end. And the king here, it seems to be incredibly prudent. We'll talk about this in a minute, but he's outmatched. The wisest thing he could do would be to surrender, to give up before the battle is joined. So when you look at those aspects of the story, it makes it seem like that the emphasis is someplace else than the typical traditional interpretation puts it. Let me highlight some of those things for you here, rather than just talking about them off the cuff. First, these are not stories about people who made sure that they had what it takes. That is, this is not the story of a person who looked at it and said, yep, I got what it takes, I'll charge ahead. These are stories about people who discovered that they did not have what it takes. This is especially clear with the second story. Jesus has set the king up for failure in advance. As Jesus tells it, the king is outnumbered. He has half the number of soldiers that his opponent has. And really, the same thing is true with the tower story. He could have told another story about a guy who had enough money. He checked and he said, yeah, I have enough money to build this tower. So he did. But the emphasis here is, no, I don't have what it takes to do this, so I shouldn't start. So it seems to me that we have to at least be interested in a way of understanding these stories that puts the emphasis there. Perhaps he's telling these stories because this is like our situation. We are like the king and the builder in the story. We don't have what it takes either. So if we could find a way of understanding it that way, that might start to make some sense. Secondly, as I mentioned before, the strong implication of both of these stories is that the characters are being commended for giving up. They were wise to count the cost in advance, but their wisdom went beyond that. They wisely quit when they discovered they couldn't finish the task. I mean, that's the way the stories read. Wasn't this a good idea that this guy didn't build this tower? He didn't have the resources for it. Isn't this a good idea that this king didn't go to battle? He's going to get creamed. He doesn't have the manpower.
The king obviously wants to win the battle. The man really wants to build a tower. You can feel the pull in the story. There's a real attraction to building this tower. And of course, the king, he wants to keep his sovereignty. He wants his kingdom to remain independent and strong. He doesn't want to surrender to this other king, but he has to face reality. He is outmanned. The prudent thing to do would be to surrender before going into battle. Knowing when to quit can be the pinnacle of wisdom. And it seems to me that that's the way these stories read. That these guys are being, the idea that you should quit, that you should give up when you recognize that you're not going to win, that seems to be commended in the story. That seems to be the thing that the story suggests to us. And then one other thing that's of interest to me is the second story, the one about the king. In this story, the king sends a delegation while the other king is still far away. That king and his armies is approaching, but he's far away. So before he arrives, because when he arrives, it's too late. When he arrives, we're going to fight. So before he arrives, he sends a delegation. Let's work out terms of peace. Well, it seems to me that that has to be interesting to us. In the story, it's interesting. I mean, like I say, it's going to be too late when the army arrives. He needs to work out the terms of peace before the other king arrives with his armies. But what has to be striking to us, at least it's striking to me, is this sounds so much like our situation with God. That is, we have this time now. God, the king, and his Messiah, the king, ultimately are going to arrive. And when they arrive, it's going to be too late. We need to seek terms now while it's still possible. Well, if you think about it that way, I mean, if you think about the God being that other king who is going to prevail if it comes to battle, so you had better come to terms with him now, that makes a lot of sense, and it changes the way we're thinking about what's happening in the story. In the more common counting the cost interpretation, the believer is being urged not to act like this king ultimately. I mean, this king, he's got to give up if he doesn't have the resources. But in the typical way of understanding this, the best scenario, of course, would be to count the cost and discover that you've got what it takes and that you can go the distance and you can win. But if we see this scenario, the other king represents God, and it's like our situation where now is the time, before it's too late, that we decide and recognize, I'm not going to win in this battle, I had better surrender. Now, God is that king. Now, I am being commended to be like that first king. I should be like him. I should give up. That's the prudent and wise thing to do. Before the king comes and totally destroys us, we should come to terms now before it's too late. Okay, so these three points that I'm making here, if you take them together, suggest that Jesus is drawing a different analogy than the one we typically suppose. He's not saying, don't be like these guys who didn't have enough to finish. He's saying, rather, you are like these guys. You don't have what it takes to finish either, so you should be prudent like they were and give up. Now, this sounds strange because we're used to thinking about it, that Jesus is saying, figure out whether you have what it takes to be my disciple. Figure out whether you have the resources that are going to be required for you to go the distance and count the cost and all that stuff. So if that's what he's saying, then the message, you don't have what it takes, give up now, that sounds strange. I mean, figure out whether you have what it takes to be my disciple, you don't, give up. That doesn't seem like what he would be saying. But I think Jesus has a different issue in mind. Remember, he concludes these stories by saying that his disciples must give up all that is theirs. So I think that Jesus is addressing in these stories the issue, should you give up? You might think that you want to find a way to not have to make this decision. You might think that what you would like to do is to find a way to keep all the things of your life. I want to keep the goodwill of my family. I don't want to lose my life. I don't want to lose any of my possessions. I don't want to give any of that stuff up. I would like to follow Jesus, but I would like to somehow work this deal so that I don't have to give anything up. Well, I think if we look at the question that way, what he's suggesting in the parables is you do not have the resources to take on God in this spot and not give up the things of your life. If you attempt that road, you're not going to be able to successfully complete it. So you'd better give up now. So let me explain what I'm thinking here. In the first story, the man has a project he wants to take on. He wants to build a tower. Now, a tower like this could serve several purposes in this culture, as I understand it. It would most likely be something like a defensive watchtower. This is someone who has a lot of wealth and property, and you put up a big tower as a place where watch can be kept over the property. It also might be used as well to store, if it's a big tower, some of your more valuable things might be stored in that tower. So presumably his goal in building a tower is to protect or enhance his property. A man with a tower is a man who has wealth and is ready to defend and keep it. Now, so this man would really like to build a tower like that. But his desire for that tower, if he lets it push him into charging ahead, he's going to be in real trouble. Because, as Jesus tells the story, he doesn't have the resources to build that tower. He's only going to get as far as laying the foundation and then no tower. So instead of having this fine tower that shows his wealth and helps him protect and keep what he has, he's going to have some rubble, some foundation with nothing on it that everybody's going to go by and laugh and say, you know, you thought you were going to really be able to pull that off? Well, I think what Jesus is suggesting is that we're all like this man. Just as he wants to build a tower so that he can store and defend his treasures, so we too have a similar goal. We're trying to find a way to protect and enhance our worldly possessions. We would like to hang on to our stuff, our lives, our relationships, our possessions, if we could. We would like to take that and build a life that is satisfying. I mean, all of us have this sense. I can make this work. I got stuff. I got relationships. I've got a life going. I can hang on to all of this stuff and make things good. We have this naive optimism that if we just charge ahead, we can keep our worldly resources and live a rich life with them. However, most people are fools. They have never asked themselves whether their resources are adequate to the project. As it happens, they do not have what it takes. No matter how hard they try, in the end, this project will come to nothing. Their possessions will fail them. They are not going to be able to bless themselves with the stuff that they have managed to keep and hold on to in this life. One day they're going to stand before the judgment seat of God and will be ashamed for the monumental waste of the opportunity that they had. Some among us, however, are wise. We are like the man in Jesus' story. Before the day of reckoning comes, we realize that we don't have what it takes for this project. We want to build this tower to protect our what we have in this life, but we can't do that. We know we can't do that. And so we have to give up on that project and find another project with a better chance of success. That is, being a follower and disciple of Jesus, where real life is to be found. I think the same thing is true in the second story. A king is planning to go to battle with another king. Why does one king go to battle with another? Why do kings fight? They fight over control and sovereignty. I want to keep my kingdom. I want to have control over my kingdom. I don't want that other king coming in here and telling my subjects what to do or telling me what to do. Wanting very much to be top dog, this king plans to go to battle with the other king. I am going to prevail. I am going to keep what is mine. I'm going to control what is mine. And I'm going to get what he's got. Being wise, however, he decides that he'd better stop and ask himself the question, can I actually do this? Can I pull this off? That king has not arrived yet. It's not time for the battle yet. Can I win this battle? And as it happens, he discovers that his opponent has two soldiers for every one of his, and he decides, actually, no, I can't win this battle. So before it ever comes to battle, while the other king is still a long way off, he sends a delegation to work out terms of peace. That is, he essentially surrenders. He's not going to be king. He's not going to be top dog. He's not going to get his way. But there was no way he could win anyway. Better to come to terms before his defeat becomes ignominious and total. If he surrenders now, he loses his independence, but under terms of peace, he and his people will live. If he fights the war, he will lose, and in the process, he may lose everything. Well, I think Jesus is saying that's our situation as well. We all want to be top dog. We all want control of our lives. And most of all, if we're honest with ourselves, we don't want God, that other king, that usurper, that enemy coming along and taking our kingdom away from us. We would like to hold on to it and make of it what we can for ourselves. Most people, however, are so foolish that they've never really asked themselves whether they have the resources to take on that project, to keep their little kingdom intact. As it happens, they do not. One day the battle will be joined. One day their enemy, the divine king, will step in and steal their kingdom away. But some among us are wise. We're like the king in Jesus' story. Before it ever comes to battle, we realize that we have lost. While that other greater king is still a long way off, while we still have time, we seek peace on his terms, realizing that we cannot impose our terms on him. Okay, so for what it's worth, this way of understanding the parables seems to me to make better sense of the stories and better sense of life than does the common interpretation. Jesus is indeed making the point, count the cost, and if you don't have what it takes, don't start. But he does not mean count the cost of being a disciple, and if you don't have what it takes, don't start. He is not saying that we must start our Christian journey confident that we have what it takes to complete it. I think that would be unwise, presumptuous, and psychologically impossible. Instead, he's saying something different. He's saying, I have told you that you must give up all that is yours. You must loosen your grip on this world. What, you think somehow you have what it takes to keep it? You want to take me on? You want to think that you can actually hold on to the stuff of your life? Before you invest yourself in that project and think that somehow you're going to be able to keep the things of this world and make them bless you, you had better look at your resources and see whether you can pull it off. I don't think you can. And if you can't pull it off, then I think you had better give up now. I think you had better let go of this world and follow me instead. He's asking us to consider now in this life whether our worldly resources are enough, whether we have what it takes to keep what we have and to take that what we have and make it somehow enrich and fulfill our lives. And we can answer that question. No, we don't have what it takes to make that work. We cannot build our tower to protect and store our worldly treasures. We cannot win against the coming king. And if that's so, then we had better admit defeat and follow Jesus. So I'll make a couple of comments here. As I said, this is not the typical way of understanding these parables, but this is what makes sense to me. I think the stories, the details of the stories make more sense this way. The thing that you feel in reading the stories, that idea that, yeah, that makes sense, you ought to give up, that resonates with us in this way of understanding it. But first of all, his basic point in this section, remember, apart from the parables themselves, is this. He's leading his disciples in a very different direction from where the rest of the world is going. Our families may not like where Jesus is taking us, and so we must decide whether we're willing to give up their approval and support. The rest of the world may not like it either. In fact, the world may dislike it so much that it seeks to take our lives. We have to decide whether we're willing to follow Jesus to the point of giving up potentially anything. The approval of our families, the approval of the world, even our lives themselves. To be his disciple may require us to give up anything and everything. We can see then that these parables add a new dimension. If I'm right in the way I'm understanding them, they add something to that picture. Because we might have a very natural reaction that somehow we do not want to pay such a price, and can't I find some middle ground somewhere? I mean, do I really have to hold loosely to everything in my life if I'm going to follow Jesus? Can I hang on to everything and still do the Jesus thing? I mean, there must be some way of, can't we negotiate this or something? I think that these stories are meant to remind us that there's no middle ground, that ultimately we don't have the resources to bless ourselves. We cannot find life on our own. If we are not a disciple of Jesus, following him into the forgiveness that comes from God and the eternal life in God's kingdom that comes through Jesus' work as the Messiah, if we are not following him and thus finding those things, then we're not going to get anywhere. We're going to lose everything. The parables, if I'm right, then, are about how foolish it is to think that you can find that middle ground. I mean, it makes no sense to start on that project if you know that you're never going to be able to get there. Either you have the resources to build the tower or you don't. Either you have the resources to defeat that coming king or you don't. And when we face into reality and recognize that we do not have those resources, we cannot build the tower in which to store and protect our worldly treasures. We cannot thwart the plans of the King of the universe. When he comes, if we have not previously made peace with him, then it's all up for us. So the stories then help us to recognize there isn't that middle ground. We have to make that choice. If I'm going to follow Jesus, then I have got to loosen my grip on what God has given me in this life. There is no option. If we think we can find another option, then we're just kidding ourselves. Now, when we use language like counting the cost, I think it's helpful to stop and remind ourselves what we're not saying in this, because the word cost sounds like we're buying something, and somehow it can come to have this flavor that what God is saying is, if you're willing to come to me and pay the price of giving up everything, then I will reward your payment by giving you eternal life. We can't remind ourselves too often that salvation is a free gift of God. He didn't have to be merciful to us. He chose gladly and freely to forgive us. This is not some sort of a purchase. Here, pay my price and I'll give you life. But the reason there is a cost to being a disciple is because some things are mutually exclusive. Sometimes you just can't have both. And we're in one of those situations. If I want to go and play at the coolest swim party that ever was, I can't stay dry. I can stay dry or I can go to the swim party, but I can't do both. I can live on the beach in Hawaii, but if I do, then I don't live in Eugene, Oregon. I mean, I can't do both of those things. And I think that's what Jesus is saying. The whole idea about counting the cost is it's going to happen, as we saw in many different places that he teaches. If you follow Jesus down that road toward eternal life, then there are things that are going to happen in this world. There are going to be people who are not happy with that. That's just true. There are going to be places where being his disciple is going to confront me with a choice. Am I going to follow him, or am I going to hold on to wealth or approval or whatever it might be? You just can't have both. I'm not paying God for my salvation. I'm just making a choice. The road to my salvation is going that way. The road that has me keeping for a while, the approval of the people around me and the wealth of the world and my life, you know, I'm going to keep breathing a little longer if I go down that road. But, you know, I am going to lose it all in the end anyway. I'm at that spot. I have to choose. I can't go down both roads. That, I think, is what Jesus is ultimately getting at. It's not pay my price and I'll give you some life. It's I've come to show you the two roads that you have to choose. Which one am I going to go down? Since it's impossible to please everyone, I'm confronted with a choice. I can please God or I can please the world. As we discussed, I think, in an earlier session, this is the language that Jesus and the people in the Bible use when they talk about fearing God. Whom do you fear? That is, who is it that it most matters to you what they think of you? If I fear men, it's what matters to me the most is what do people think about me? I don't want them to hurt me. I don't want them to dislike me. I don't want them to mistrust me. Or do I fear God? That is recognizing that God is the one whose favor matters most in the world. As Jesus says in another passage that we quote around here all the time, all the world can do is kill you. And that shows us the stark nature of the choice that we have in front of us. I'm not looking to just keep breathing for a while. I'm looking for eternal life. And I get that by following Jesus wherever that road might take me. Now, I know this is sobering kind of stuff to talk about. I don't stand up here trying to present myself as a paragon of courage in facing the prospect of losing the approval of family and losing my life and losing my possessions. I mean, I've had plenty of cowardly moments in my life, but those are the moments that we have to go through, I think. I mean, we can't not face into them. Being a follower of Jesus is going to get us in those spots where we have to make that choice. Like I say, it's inevitable ultimately, because the way God is going and the way the world is going are two different places. Sooner or later, those roads are diverging, and there's only so long that you can try to straddle them. Sooner or later, you're going to have to decide, which of these roads am I actually on? So, again, we're not earning our salvation by showing off how big a price we can pay. We are merely making the unavoidable choice. Jesus says that if we will follow him, he will give us rest. The world kind of makes us the same offer. Keep me happy, the world says, and I will give you rest. Well, one of them is wrong. You know which one I think is wrong. So I'm ready for your questions and incredulity and whatever you want to hit me with here.
So I noticed that you avoided about the salt and losing its saltiness and that kind of thing. or maybe you didn't avoid it, maybe you just didn't get to it. I was wondering how that works into the parable.
That was in that parable? The salt?
Following it? Immediately following?
Oh. Oh, well, no, that's true. I didn't go there. I wasn't trying to avoid it.
Can I
forgot.
Guess as to what it might be saying?
Sure, yeah.
It's always puzzled me, and so I was sitting here trying to have an epiphany like you did. It didn't work, but this is the best I can come up with. Could he be saying something along the order of, what does it profit a man if he loses or gains the whole world and loses his soul? That losing his soul is the analogous to salt losing its saltiness? That in the context of these parables, you're actually making a choice between your soul, which God can kill, and gaining the whole world immediately preceding losing your soul. So could that be what he's saying?
Well, I imagine it could. That's not how I understand it.
Okay.
But and I'm influenced. Now, this is Luke that we're looking at here, but this theme shows up in Matthew's version of what we call the Sermon on the Mount, where he's talking about persecution. It's a very similar thing. I mean, the idea that that in following Jesus, we're going to face the disapproval of those who disapprove of Jesus, and that's a blessed place to be. You want to be in that spot. Well, the thing about the salt in the Sermon on the Mount has two other little sayings that go along with it. One of them is the one about the city set on a hill that can't be hidden, and the other one is the one about you don't light a lamp and then put it under a bushel. And I think, so my understanding is that each of those has a common thread that's running through them, that they each in a different way are highlighting this idea that, see, what is it that draws the fire of the world? Why is it that we would end up being hated by the world if the world hates Jesus? Well, it's because in following him, we have come to reflect in some way the very values and things that he represented that the world does not like. So the temptation, I think the idea of the salt is that temptation to find the middle ground. Could I somehow be a follower of Jesus and yet not stick out, not be salty and different tasting? But that's where he's saying, well, look, a city set on a hill can't be hidden. You can't, if you're a city set on a hill, you can't have the strategy for your defense of, I know, let's be invisible. Can't do that. You're stuck. I mean, that's, if you're going to be a city set on a hill, then everybody going by is going to see you. You just have to deal with that. So you're going to have to deal with your problem another way. Well, so I think it's Jesus' way of responding to that desire that we might have to not be distinctive, to not have to face those choices. So if, when he's saying, if the salt isn't salty, you throw it out, he's saying it isn't possible to be a disciple of mine who does not distinctively stick out in this world as a possible object of disapproval is like talking about salt that isn't salty. I mean, what good is salt that isn't salty? I mean, it's not salt anymore. I mean, it's, you throw it out. So likewise, the very act of being my disciple is like being a city set on a hill, or like salt. It has its distinctive flavor and role, and you can't help it. That's what I would understand.
So another modern cliche would be the nail that sticks up is the one that gets pounded.
Yeah, I think so.
Just one other comment. I just happened to be looking at Genesis recently, And I noticed that, I can't find it, but in Genesis 3, when God talks to Adam after they've eaten the apple, and he says, because you listened to the voice of your wife and ate the fruit, therefore, you know, all this stuff is going to happen. And I guess I'd never really thought about because you listened to the voice of your wife, but in the context of what you were talking about, it struck me, you know, God created Adam first, and he was lonely. And when he gave Adam Eve, that was a great blessing to him. And I'm sure he was very grateful. But in the situation where Eve grabs the apple and eats it, and God has said, in the day that you eat of it, you're going to die, I wonder if Adam was thinking, I'm a loser. I can't bear the thought of going back to being alone like I was. And so he was in a situation where he had to choose to be with his wife, I guess, or to obey God. He had to make a choice to hate his wife and love God, just the way Jesus is saying, if anybody doesn't hate his wife or his mother or whatever. Do you think that could be going on there?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, at least sometimes it's hard. You all know me. I'm a conservative when it comes to these kind of things. I like things to kind of flash at me and say, see, this is why you should think that this is what this passage is doing. And sometimes if I can't find that thing flashing at me that's saying that, then I'm a little hesitant to be confident that I've understood that. So I'm not totally confident that that's what's going on, but actually it does make a lot of sense, and you're right, that idea does resonate with what we're looking at here, is for Adam to do the right thing in that situation was going to cost him, and it's exactly the kind of cost that Jesus is talking about here, is that I'm going to be cut off and find myself more lonely than I want to be.
I was just wondering, I guess the thing that kind of struck me was, why did God say, he didn't merely say, because you ate of the fruit of the tree. He said, because you listened to the voice of your wife and ate the fruit of the tree. And I wondered if what the significance of that was, because you listened to your wife's voice in preference to my voice.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, I think that has to be true, right? I mean, if I'm remembering the scenario in Genesis, I mean, everybody's passing the buck, right? I mean, Eve is saying, well, you know, the serpent, he's the one who made me do this. And then Adam says, well, she gave it to me. I mean, you know, she's the one who did this. And so, in a sense, I mean, Eve listened to the voice of the serpent, and Adam listened to the voice of his wife. So in a sense, there is that. Yeah, I mean, why are you pointing at them? I mean, you had a choice as to whether you were going to listen to me or listen to them, and you listened to them. And so I think, to a certain extent, that has to be true. Whether that includes the idea that the reason he listened to her was not just, yeah, that would be cool, that is a good-looking apple. I mean, all the stuff that she said, you know, she saw it was attractive and it was desirable to make one wise and all that stuff. I mean, I suppose it's possible that she convinced him somehow that that was the case and that that was his motive. That's why I say I'm a little hesitant to say exactly what he was thinking. But what you're saying makes sense, too. I mean, it could be all of that. I mean, I think Adam is in the situation where, if I'm understanding the scenario, I think we have every reason to think that Adam ought to understand better what's at stake here. That Adam ought to be, that he is less naive than Eve is in this situation, because he got there first and has had the instructions and all this stuff and everything. So it is very significant that he listened to her voice, that he didn't go the way God had told him to. But yeah, so that's good.
Not a question, just a comment. This morning I just finished C.S. Lewis, Surprised by Joy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't read it, it's just the story of his reluctant conversion and the end when he actually goes kicking and screaming
right.
into realizing that he has to
right.
Accept that God is the one that's in charge. I just recommend it. It's great reading.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the spot where he... Yeah, that is a good book. That's a very good book.
Thank you. I actually have never made much sense of these parables. And just kind of like, oh, okay, whatever. doesn't sound right, but... So this has been really helpful, and I actually didn't read your article 17 years ago. one of my questions is, you use the word because obviously it's a part of the stories, especially the tower building story, of you don't have the resources to complete this. You also use the phrases like you can't bless yourself. Does it seem synonymous with you to put the words you're not in control? Whoever said you would get what you wanted, or that your dreams are God's dreams, and therefore do whatever you need to do to make sure your dreams come true. On the bless yourself, even if it means trying to establish some middle ground and have it all. I guess I've complicated it. Let me back up and ask, do you think here one of the main things is give up because you're not in charge? The only thing to do is to surrender? Or am I trying to pull some other stuff in here that you don't think belongs?
I think that must be a very good and subtle question. Because I'm a little bit tired. Actually, not a little bit tired. And I am incapable of coming up with an answer to what you just said. I don't know. I mean, it's not the way I was thinking about it. I mean, that's probably the main reason. I guess you could say that's the main reason why I don't have the resources. But I'm thinking about it just in terms of the way he's described it. Look, there's something in following me, there is stuff that happens. The world is going to be unhappy with you, and that unhappiness is going to manifest itself in various ways, and that's going to affect you. It's going to, and so the things like, I would like to keep these relationships intact, or I would like to keep my life. The thing is, I can keep my life. I mean, there are those spots where people have been in situations where, you know, the classic sort of, you know, renounce Jesus or you're going to the lions kind of stuff, and they could have had their life a little longer if they had said, okay, I renounce Jesus. But yeah, the fact is that if I do that, I'm not really ultimately gaining. I can't really accomplish what it looks like I'm trying to do. I'm trying to keep this stuff and make it work somehow, as if somehow that my retaining my life a little longer, or my retaining the goodwill of people who don't like Jesus a little longer, is somehow going to solve my problem. Somehow I'm going to come out okay if I just do that. And you could say I'm not in control. You could also say that ultimately death is inevitable, and I am going to have to deal with the one who truly determines the destiny of every human being. And those are very related ideas, I guess. That's not a very good answer. I'm really tired.
So I don't know. Subtle question.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
Does that? I'm not going to ask you if that made sense. That's my answer, and I'm sticking with it.
Okay, and maybe just one more question.
No, please. Sure.
From what you've said about the two stories together, it seems like the first one, the tower builder, that if it was just the tower builder story, it mm-hmm. wouldn't make sense what you're mm-hmm. saying.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the second story that really helps you out, filling it out the way you have in terms of rephrasing the question?
No, that's fair. Yes, I think that's true. I'm not sure I would say that the first one wouldn't make sense without the second one, but it's the second one. I mean, you know, for better or worse, my little epiphany that I described, I was looking at the second story when that, it was that, oh, you know, the king, he hasn't come yet. Make peace with him now before he arrives. I've heard that kind of language before. And that's the thing that then I go back to the other story and say, well, what about that? I wrote a paper on these two parables when I was going to RTS, and so I did some research on looking at commentaries and stuff to see what people did with this. And I found one person who did something very interesting. They agreed with what I was saying about the parable of the king and the battle and everything. He was taking it the way I'm taking it here. But the first one, he was taking it the traditional way. So he was taking the two stories differently. And I looked at that and I thought, it seems to me that there are too many elements that are similar in this story, that if you're going to take the king story the way I'm taking it, that the first one really needs to kind of more or less match. So I suppose it's possible that I haven't given enough thought to that, and maybe both of them would actually work, but I don't think so. It is, I mean, it's not that you couldn't make the other way of taking it work. I mean, If I were forced to say, could we make some sort of sense out of the traditional interpretation? Yeah, I think we could. We could soften it and make it so that it was something that it would least we could say, oh yeah, I guess you could sort of say that that's true. But I don't. What I like about what I've proposed here is it just seems to, the things that seem striking about the stories that seem most obvious about them take center stage in the way I'm thinking about it, which is what I like. Okay, so I think it's six. I think we'll stop there.